Welcome to an all-new episode of Comedy Gold Mines, where we do what, people? Huh? We get inside the minds of brilliant comedians, and oh my God, what amazing minds they are. And today, well, today, this mind is one that I'm just in awe of, because this is a mind that's done so much, been in the business for so long, achieved high levels of success. This guest needs no introduction. By the way, which is the name of their newest show, which is on Netflix? My guest needs no introduction. There's only a couple people that can pull a title like that off that you can't even question. This man is one of them. God, how lucky am I? Ladies and gentlemen, David Letterman.
Thank you, Kevin. That was very nice.
Oh, man. Dude, I'm honored. I'm honored to be on the opposite side of this conversation.
Let me just say that I have great admiration for you. And maybe you've heard this story, and maybe I've told this to you in person. But if I haven't, I've told it to many, 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 many other people. And I find it very satisfying to tell. I believe the first time you were on the show, do you know the story I'm about to tell?
I want to hear it. No, tell me.
Okay. The segment producer named Brian Tedda comes out to me during the commercial. The band is playing and you're about to be introduced. And he said to me, he said, I don't know. He didn't really give me a pre-interview. And all he would say to me was, don't worry, I can make anything funny. And I thought, oh, it's one of these guys. Let's see how this goes. So I was really excited and quietly hoping that you would come out and start perspiring and stumbling and muttering and perhaps even twitching. So you came out, you sat down, bang, zoom. And at the end of the two segments, I said to my friend Brian, holy crap, he can make anything funny.
Wow.
I've never seen that machine. That was the only time I've seen that machine in my experience. So it was great. And I love telling the story because I was so happy to be proven wrong. It was great.
You know what? I remember the moment. I remember the moment clear as day because I went through this phase. You know, when you first start and, you know, David, you start getting the levels of success, and there's a marketing and promo that's attached to it, right? And you're in position to now get across those late night stages. And, you know, it was the first time that all the pre-interviews were being thrown at me of the things that you want to talk about and the direction that you want to go and give us some things. And, you know, that's how they help navigate the conversation. And more importantly, it just helps the host, right?
Yeah, it really is an aid to the host. And also, I think the goal historically for the pre-interview was to make both the guest and the host look as good as they're going to look in 8 minutes, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember saying, you know, I was like, I don't like the pre-interview. I feel like I'm good enough of a talker and I'm good enough in a conversation to pick up something if it's down and to amplify it if it needs the volume turned up or down. Like I think I'm kind of good at that. I don't want to give the pre-interviews. I said, is there any way where we can just talk? And it got to a point where it started to become more of a believable thing where the publicist that I was working with, I guess, started to convince the producers that I would be fine because I was finding discomfort in it. And I remember doing your show and I remember them going, okay, well, we're just going to, you know, just give us a couple of things. And my publicist gave some bullet points, but I didn't. I was like, we're going to be fine. This is me on David Letterman. I'm so hyped to sit in that chair. I couldn't wait to sit in that chair. It was the biggest thing for me to sit in that chair. It was, you know, these are moments of I've arrived and it's all happening. And I swear to you, I remember that conversation.
Yeah. Well, you're flattering me, but the impressive part of that was you. But you know, I think you're right. The idea, I mean, I got it from when I was a guest on The Tonight Show, and they held that very rigid, that you had to go through the pre-interview, and then you did another pre-interview when you got to the studio. And I think it was just because they wanted everything to be as slick and as smooth. And Kevin, you'll be surprised to know that not everybody can acquit themselves talking on TV for
a absolutely.
So it was, you know, all boats rise with the tide. And I think it was to help people who in show business, in spite of the fact that they couldn't hold a conversation.
you know what, man? Right now I have an opportunity, right? I have an opportunity to talk to you and ask you questions. And, you know, I could go down the traditional lane and ask you questions where people already know the answer. We know that you've been on late night. We know that you spent years on late night, and we know a lot of the stories. And if you don't know, it's not hard for you to educate yourself and find out the story. I want to talk to you about your now, right? And here's why. You seem to have such a different calm over you now. And I'm watching your show on Netflix. My guest needs no introduction. And your approach to it, you know, the top of the shows, you're loose with the crowd, the audience. What is the difference? What do you feel is the major difference for you in your world of talk show now than what it was when you had Letterman?
Thank you for the observation. And I'll tell you, there is a deeper response here than the question might suggest. Mm. But not doing the show that I did for 30 years, I have realized that my direction, attention, and energy was misplaced for a long, 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 long time. And that life, specifically my life, went around me like a stone in a stream. The water breaks and goes around it. So you don't get the benefit of the stream on either side of the stone. You just get what divides the water. And that was me. I was so fixated on the show that other parts of my life or anybody else's life that was close to me was overlooked or second or third tier. So what I have realized since then is that you know, you're not the most important person on television. You're not even the most important person in your family, but I certainly behaved that way for a long, long time. So in approaching the Netflix show, the schedule has greater humanity. We're only doing a handful at a time. And I think you probably understand what I'm talking about.
That's so clear.
Yeah. Because in talking to you now, I can see being on the other side of this equation, you get it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I stopped doing it, and you mentioned the word calm, and that was never associated with me and still can't be associated with me to the degree I wish it was. But it takes the frenetic aspect, which typically is artificial, and lets you see really what is not artificial.
How did you come to the realization, though? Like, it doesn't just happen. You know, I know what my moment was. I know what, and honestly, verbatim, you know, to
some
degree.
What was your moment?
Well, my moment was the accident. You know, my moment was my accident. And you know, I've talked about it before, but it for me, that moment was, you're not in control. That moment was, you don't run shit. You're not in control. You use the word I too much, and you have been. And right now, you've been told to sit the fuck down.
Yeah.
Basically, to some degree, I've been told to sit down and take a real look around me. I had to take a real look around me. And when you're talking about observation, when you're talking about the feeling of being the most important and everything has to revolve around you, I heard that. I heard that. It registered. And, you know, when I was in that hospital and I'm in that hospital room, and you look around and those four walls are filled with three or four people, that whole thing that I was holding on to, of fame, of volume, of need and energy, didn't matter. It didn't matter. It was my wife, my kids, my brother. Oh, fuck. This is, look at my real energy source.
Yeah.
Am I giving them this energy that they're giving me? Am I doing it at the same level? That was the real fucking, that was the real gut check for me. So what was yours? What was your moment of realization?
Thank God I didn't have as dramatic a moment as did you, but the effect is the same. It just took longer for me. It was when I stopped doing the nightly show, because when I was doing the nightly show, and Lord knows how long I was doing it, the first thing I would do in the morning would be to look at the ratings. And if we were competitive in the ratings, I felt comfortable. If we had been defeated or humiliated in the ratings, my stomach would be churned up and in knots. And that's how I would spend my day. And once I stopped doing the show, and there were no ratings on what I had done the day before, that slowly seeped away from me. And it was like getting a new prescription of eyeglasses. You started seeing things more clearly. You started seeing other things that you're supposed to see, other things that are automatic that I had blinders on. And it's embarrassing for me to admit this. And I feel supported knowing that you went through another form of it. But the real question is, as I remember from my heart surgery, which was a long time ago now, that's supposed to be a life-changing moment too. But there's something about the human machine that will not hang on to these peaks and to these valleys. The human machine always goes back to the mundane. And there will come a time, and it is time, away from the realization that you had, the realization that I had, that you lose the importance of that moment. Now, I'm lucky because I'm not going back to fight the war. You have to go back and fight the war. You're working. You have to prove yourself every time out. And so you have to be cautious that doesn't supersede what you learned via your experience.
I just had this conversation, my friend Harry, one of my best friends. We're out in Budapest. It's a lot. The scenery is amazing. We're taking a walk, right? A walk. And I want my listeners to hear this. We're taking a walk. And I want you to ask yourself, when's the last time you've taken a walk? And do you still understand the value behind taking a walk? You know, the car has done so much damage to us that we forgot what steps are and the benefit that comes from it. And during this walk, we're talking, and I told Harry, David, I said, dude, you know what I'm starting to really understand and what I'm really starting to see is that I'm not a victim of the business. And what happens is the business, it grabs you in a way to where, just like you were talking just now, you were talking about checking the ratings, the number one, the if you're not, if this, and it's to nobody's fault because there's no handbook. We don't get a handbook when we start this that tells us how we should operate, how we're supposed to navigate. And it's about number one. It's about the best. It's about the biggest. It's about the biggest comedy, the biggest thriller of the year, the best movie. Everything is about the best. And what happens when you get wrapped up into that, if things come your way and it's not that, there is no feeling of success that's attached. It only becomes a feeling of failure unless you have the mindset to operate in it correctly.
Right.
And at the age 41, I was telling Harry, I said, dude, I'm not a prisoner of that because I'm not trapped in that. I understand that my wins are being able to do what I want to do and being able to be happy within my creative. Those are my wins. And he said, so do you feel like you lose when you don't get number one? I said, no, but only because I've experienced it. If I didn't experience that, I wouldn't know that the feeling of having it is the same of not having it. Like it's, you gotta play the game and be in the game to truly understand it. And dude, it's, as you see, I'm getting passionate when I'm talking because what you're saying, I clearly understand. And there's not many that can, because they don't have the opportunity for those lenses to get wiped of the fog.
Yeah.
And I think it's so dope to hear you talk the way that you talk now. You know, it's refreshing to see clear.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And the problem with me, and maybe this is true with everyone, When I could make a room full of people laugh, whether it was in the beginning at a club in California or in a studio at NBC, then I would feel I was worth something. Mm. If I didn't, if I bombed or we had a lousy show, then I would have another period where I felt worthless. And it wasn't till I could get another chance to make people laugh that I felt like I was worth something. And that's sad. So with that mechanism behind me, I have to take what I have and learn to be okay with it.
Was there somebody that you had to confide in to help you get this mental grasp? Like, was there somebody that helped point you in the right direction of understanding yourself and why you were feeling the way you were feeling or how you were feeling the way you were feeling that allowed you to get here?
Yeah, that's of course I had help. But I never ever felt comfortable sharing this with anybody because I thought it was, if it became public, it would be looked on as, oh, he's a weak person. Mm. Perhaps I am. But I did share it with people. I've been in and out of therapy. The problem with therapy for me is after a while I get, you know, it's the same old stories. I get bored with my material. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, oh, then I start making stuff up to entertain the psychiatrist. And I feel like I'm really getting paid here. I'm paying the person. But I got to recognizing a pattern of my life, which was I did so-and-so and so-and-so to make me feel okay. I used to be an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And I remember clearly having conversations with a person close to me asking me why I was drunk on the living room floor many years ago. And the question was, why are you always drunk? Fair enough question. And I said, because I just like the way I feel drunk. I feel better drunk than when I'm not drunk. Mm. And there was that device that followed me throughout my life. And it's the same as every night I get a chance to prove my worth. And as you grow older, the wisdom of life kind of compounds and accumulates, and you sort of start to, you know, it's time now to land this.
I like what you're saying so much. And this is all, you know, this is news to me. You know what I mean? This is the value of Comedy Gold Mines. You know, this is why I did this. Honestly, it's a selfish reason behind me doing the podcast, and that's to talk to people that I admire, but to have really deep conversations where I can walk away with a different level of understanding. Because what we do in this business, we meet people and we say we know them without knowing them.
Right.
Right? It's a habit of old that we all have. Yes, I know him. Oh, he's a good guy. Mm-hmm. That's a good person. Great person. Love them. Yes. And you don't really know them. And I don't want that.
It's often a difference between, and sadly, I think this is true in life, difference between show business friends, because I met, lucky enough to meet every significant man or woman act in any variety of show business. But how many of them were my friends? Well, sadly, not many of them were actually my friends. I was always glad to see them. But to the point you're making, you know, they're not your real friends.
Absolutely. Do you feel now at this point of clarity and where you are in your life and doing the show, when you're talking to people, right? I can only assume, and my assumption could be wrong here, that sometimes you hear what people are saying and you know that people are where you were, or that some people are in that space and you can possibly have a moment of, oh boy, oh my God. Like, I wonder, should I say something? Like, should I pull this particular person aside and say, hey, take the time to really, really look around and just appreciate what's going on. Like, do you ever have moments like that now, you know, after talking to guests, where you want to pull some people aside to maybe prevent the things that you know are going to happen?
Yeah, this is interesting. This has never come up. The Netflix show, I'm lucky because it's like this. We can talk. We can actually talk. I don't know what the time limit is here. I know the Hungarian authorities might break in and shut us down at any minute.
We can talk. We can talk. We're good.
So that's what I like about the Netflix show. But there was an occasion a few years ago when somebody I knew of, again, not friends, but knew of, and knew was having some difficulty, the same kind of difficulty I once had. And I struggled with the idea, should I go to this person and say, I learned this lesson. I hope you can learn it. But, you know, I didn't. I was timid because I felt ultimately, you know, I'm not in a position to be telling somebody how to live their life. But, and I believe from what I understand, the realization came for this person and no longer shares the situation that I was in. So maybe it should happen more, but I just never had that kind of confidence. I mean, have you done that? Have you taken somebody aside and said,
I told this, I forgot who I was talking to. I was talking to somebody else on my podcast, man. And I was telling them a story about like Will Smith. Will Smith said something to me that rocked me, fucking rocked me, man. And it put me in a position to no longer want to give advice, but I'll get information. Will Smith said something to me. He said, dude, I found out that I was like a selfish individual. He said, and the reason why is because when I gave advice, it was for people to become me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, when you give advice and you're telling people what to do, you're telling them the way you did it most of the time. And if people don't choose to do it like that, sometimes you get upset and go, well, then you don't want to win or you don't want to be successful. When in return, what you're saying is, you don't want to become me. He said, and I had to realize that. I had to realize the selfish approach to what I thought was help wasn't help at all. It was a moment of me in my ego. And at this age, once again, an older man now, who sees life in a completely different way. And just how you and I are talking, the conversation I had with him was mind-blowing in the same way, because it's going down the same road of evolving and maturing. And he said, now I give information. And people have a choice to either use the information or not. So when you say, have I done it? No, because I feel like people have, that's the beauty of life. The beauty of life is discovery.
Right, yeah.
And who am I to take your discovery away?
That's right.
And who am I to prohibit you from discovering? Now, I can say, hey, let me give you some information about something that I know through some experiences that I've had just to give it to you. And if you choose to take it once again, great. If not, great. But ever since I talked to Will, I've taken away that piece of me that used to love to give advice of how I got to, and here's what you do.
Yeah. I always said to myself, I don't feel like I'm qualified to influence people in matters of conscience. And
wow,
you're exactly right. You're kind of wanting to demonstrate a superiority if you tell them what to do, as opposed to just dispensing advice. But still, it's a fine line. And you understand how, if you're telling them what to do, that resentment can grow from that. So you have to be careful. So Will is exactly right. But still, to dispense advice, you have to be prepared for it might get sideways on the person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right now, you and your world of entertainment, you know, you said something to me early on where you were like, Kevin, you know, you're in it. And you said, you're not, you know, you're on the other side of it. Is there a stop date for you? This is another question I love to ask. Are you at the point where there's a specific date where it all ends? Or is this just now, is it something to enjoy in a space of comfort that you do, and you may create other things, you may do other things? Where are you at in the business right now?
Geez, that's...
I'm getting good at this, David.
I tell you, here's my trouble, or one of my troubles. I keep forgetting my chronologic age. I keep actually forgetting it.
I love that.
And somebody, I was talking to somebody today, and she reminded me, it was a wife of a good friend of mine. And she said, you know, the twins of so-and-so are 61 now. Now, the last time I saw the twins, they were 14. And I thought, holy shit, those kids are really old.
Wow.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm still older than the alarming age these kids are.
Wow.
So I keep forgetting that. And I think people do. They put it away. My goal is, I feel like the person that I operated as for so many years was reading the wrong handbook. And that's what I'm trying to, and it comes reflexively, because you're not in that circumstance, so you're not going to behave that way, thank God. And I'm fond of saying I probably should have quit 10 or 15 years before I did, because I bypassed a lot of things and behaved in ways that was not helpful, not friendly, not without hurting some people. So in terms of how long will I pursue it? I don't know, you know, good question, but I don't know. I think, geez, it's just a miserable ego of people like me, where you think, I'll keep doing it until I feel better about myself. Well, good luck.
Well, what you're saying is just, it's so amazing and so necessary for now, right? Because what now lacks is compassion for a you. Mm-hmm. And here's what I mean when I say that. For a person that's grown. For a person that's a version of who he or she used to be. Like we lack compassion for that. We've lost sight of the ability to grow, of the ability to throw the older you away because of seeing clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Clarity is unbelievable, man.
Yeah.
You know, when you say blinders and you had blinders on, I want my listeners to truly understand what that means. That's real. Having blinders on and being blind to your surroundings is real. It's real as a victim of it. Talking to a fellow victim of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see what you are oblivious to. And it's not until something happens that takes your mind on a whirlwind to make you go, holy shit, what was I thinking? What was I doing? Who was I? Why was I? Can you make the decision to leave that behind and be better?
Now, let me ask you a question, because I think about this all the time. If I had stayed in my hometown and never made the move to kind of try what I tried, that wouldn't have worked. I think I would have ended up dead from alcoholism. So it was necessary to make that move. On the other hand, it was so self-consuming as to be damaging to others.
I mean, it's the gift and the curse of it.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's the gift and the curse. Like if it was all perfect, is it really worth it?
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say it. I hate to say it, but your stars are stars for a reason, right? And you know, the lives of stars may not all be as complex, but they're complicated. There's a lot of complication that comes with that star, with that bright light, with that opportunity. And once again, I go back to the handbook. It's because none of us are taught how to operate within that spotlight. And it comes fucking fast. And what comes with it, the power, the control, the money, the opportunity, it's like nothing you've ever seen or imagined. So, you know, I get it when you're talking about 30 years. You right now, I can only imagine how you think about the 30 years gone. That 30 years probably fucking now when you look back, you go, holy shit. 30 years?
Blink of an eye.
on TV.
Yeah.
Like, do you understand? Like, it's unheard of. Unheard of. I love what you're saying, because it needs to be heard. What is your mindset on this culture of not understanding, on the culture of cancel, on the culture of you, damn you, be done with you. Mm-hmm. You know, what is your mindset? And granted, I want to make this very clear. To some degree, it's understandable. Some things have to be dealt with in the manner of which they have been. Some things, absolutely, I understand it, I get it. But it's bled into the side of, you know, it's a little blurred now. What's your take on the level of attempt behind cancel culture and not really being patient with one's opportunity to fucking grow?
Well, I feel like, and a lot of this stuff I was unaware of. Mm-hmm. And now to see it play out and to invoke the phrase cancel culture and to recognize that people may be guilty of overreacting, too eager to cancel things that perhaps need to be modified, not canceled. On the other hand, I fully believe things need to be fixed. So let's try to fix everything. We're not going to succeed, but let's try. And if we are overly aggressive in making judgment and applying the so-called cancel culture, fine. We can fix that later. Mm-hmm. The bigger problems maybe need this kind of attention. So let's work on those. And mm-hmm. if we make mistakes trying to improve the world, we'll come back and get to those later.
I like that. I'm all about solution, not the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Once you figure out the problem, we're now talking about solution. And figuring that out, it doesn't have to be as complex, I think, right, as sometimes we make it.
Because I think a lot of the problems people ignored. And so now for them to turn up their nose at solutions or over solutions or greater scrutiny, well, that's better than ignoring them, you know? Let's go. Let's examine everything.
Are your loved ones as intrigued with this version of you as I am? Are they as blown away and just like in awe of hearing you talk the way you talk now?
How old are your kids?
I am all across the board. I got 16, 13, 3 and 8 months.
Oh, God bless you. That's just fantastic.
Yeah. It's a fucking mess is what it is. That's what it is.
it's like a petting zoo.
Yeah, it's a goddamn mess.
Well, you and I can talk about the 16-year-old. I have a 17-year-old.
Oh.
And oh, my. I mean, at the end of every day, it's so good. But to navigate that day is not without pitfalls. And I don't know if your kids hurt your feelings, but I have one. And I always wish I had like your family. That's great. Mm-hmm. Because you've got a Whitman sampler there. I just get the one snarky 17-year-old.
I love it, man. I can say, you know, but here's the thing, no, David, it's just happened. You know, I don't come from this. I don't come from the big family. I don't come from dinner at 8 p.m. and, you know, we say a prayer and then eat. I don't come from, hey, let's do tacos Tuesdays and game nights and, you know, help with homeworks. I don't come from that. I come from figure it the fuck out. So now being in a situation where we're putting tests and drawings on a refrigerator and, you know, the birthday parties are in house and family dinners, it's a thing. You know, I found myself falling in love with breaking a chain of old in my family. And by the way, in that navigation of getting here, I ain't been perfect. I done fucked up so many times because of where I come from. I'm trying to still fix my shit and make sure that I'm adapting properly to this opportunity at hand, man. But it's really blossomed into something nice. And you know, it's added as a reason for me to, you know, see a little more clear. than what I once
well,
was.
This is one of the mistakes that I made. You know, I understood that there is an age limit on having children. You know, when the wife and the husband get to be close to 100, probably not going to have kids. Mm. But I was fixated on the damn show. And as much as I love my son, I wish he had siblings. But this is the residue. This is collateral damage to the life I led, from the life I led.
Mm. And talking to your son now, I mean, you know, are these conversations that you've had and opened up like that to your son?
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no. Okay, Dad, fine. That's enough. No, thanks. I'm good. That's the conversations we have, Kevin. How was school today? Okay. What classes did you have?
Usual.
Yeah. Was it good?
You know.
That's as close as we get now.
I'm a relator, of course. I mean, my oldest is 16, like I said, and that's my little girl, man. And it's looking in the mirror. You know, my daughter knows everything. She's the smartest 16-year-old ever walked the face of this earth. She's 16, going on 85. She's done it all. I know nothing. I know nothing at all. So it's one of those things.
I've heard, and I've said this before, that the people with 16-year-old girls say, oh, buddy, hang on. The ride is not over. Yeah. Have you experienced that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I embrace every moment, especially in today's time, you know, because this generation is different. You know, this generation is very expressive, feelings, outspoken. You know, it's not the same from when I was coming up. It's damn near not the same from when you were coming up. So, you know, what I've learned to do and what I've adapted to is you have to listen. But I'm a heavy listener, and the communication in my household is at a very high level. And it's not about me telling. It's about us discussing, talking, and figuring it out. Everything is handled differently because of how this generation navigates. And you have to be mindful. It's the same way we were just talking about, you know, the cancel culture and how some things are necessary and needed. You have to be mindful of these things and respectful. It's no different with the generation today.
I realized early and re-realize all the time that the experience I had growing up in no way has any similarity to the way my son is growing up.
Absolutely.
Well, it's just completely different. So drawing on that level of experience is no good. You know, I'll give you only because this happened last night. And this just, sometimes it makes me laugh. Sometimes I just double over and think, oh Jesus, what have I done here? Well, last night, I think I'm going fishing. So I say to my son, I said, you know, the night before I went fishing and I caught a fish and I couldn't, as I was reaching down to unhook the fish, he spit the fly. So I said, you just come along now with the net. I just need a net guy.
Do I have to?
Well, no, you don't have to. But why don't you?
I'll be down later.
So later he comes out where I'm fishing, and it's,
how long do I have to stay here?
And I said, well, I'll catch a fish, and then you're free to go. So it just made me laugh. I said, you really don't want to be here, do you? And he said,
no, I really would rather not be here.
And I said, okay, you can go. But how does that not hurt your feelings?
Yeah, yeah. It's an opportunity to fish.
But is it worth an argument?
No.
I mean, my father would have said, God damn it.
Sit your ass right here.
Yeah,
and
we're
don't
fishing.
Move. Hold the goddamn net until I get a fish, and you better shut your mouth. I would have been right there. That's my dad as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. My dad.
When I was
a
kid, it was... oh, yeah? And then somebody grabs you by the arm, takes you where they want you to be. Well, you can't do that. That was wrong, too.
You can't do it today. And you, but
no, you can't. You shouldn't have done it then.
No. You now see that. Yeah. We now understand that. You know, my son, I don't know how, but he's grown to develop a love for the gym. He loves to be in the gym with me. So like, that's our time. That's our bonding time. And my daughter, what I've learned to do with my daughter is, you know, I make sure that she has her separate moments where she has me to herself. Mm-hmm. That's what's most important to her, because we got such a big household. I'm constantly being shared. So for her, it's having dad by herself. So, you know, us in the car, taking drives, going out, little lunch dates with she and I, like that's what she values. But I had to figure that out.
Well, see, this is part of what I envy, because I know how my son is. I know pretty much I can predict his behavior in a wide variety of circumstances. Mm-hmm. Often I'm wrong, but generally not. I would like that same evaluation process with other personalities in my house. Mm-hmm. You have that. You have a great variety. I don't. I just have, yeah, no, thanks, bye.
Here's a good question for you, and I'm excited to ask this one. This is about the business today and the direction that it's going in, right? You're coming from 30 years of TV. You've seen TV navigate only in one direction, network, CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox. You've seen it. It's been traditional. You've then seen the internet become what it's become. Holy shit, look at social media. You saw from the fucking beginning to where it is now. You have seen the world change, and you've seen entertainment be affected from the changes. Now with these streaming platforms, which you now have partnered with, you've seen how it's taken off, and you're now available in all of these countries, 250 different countries your talk show is available. Is it mind-blowing to you to see how the broadcasting distribution has grown and the direction that it's going in?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you put it aptly. When I was in LA trying to become successful as in comedy or show business, there were three outlets. Fox hadn't arrived yet. But what I have seen and experienced firsthand is that the entertainment, especially men and women doing stand-up comedy now, their comedy is so far more sophisticated than the stuff that the 200 or 300 of us were doing back in the 70s and the 80s. Mm. And you would think that with all of these, it's like if the NFL expanded to 50 teams, you would think that the talent would water down. And that's what I would expect with the streaming platforms and but it doesn't seem to have. It seems like, it's a great place to revisit the inventory. It's like the Library of Congress. Here's everything that was ever produced on TV. And if you would like to educate yourself or you wanted to see it again, it's all available. So there's that part of it. Take it or leave it, like it or not. But that does exist. There are so many more chances. And what's wrong with more chances for anybody? Well, nothing really. You know, you'll sink or swim. Doesn't make any difference if there's 1,000 possibilities or if there's 50 possibilities. If you're good enough, you're going to get in that lineup. And I'm overwhelmed at the stuff that it's like going through an encyclopedia. You don't think you get to LMNOP, whatever. You think, well, there's nothing in this that will interest me, but you're wrong. There's always something else out there that will interest you. And the number and people, I know nothing about these guys and women who are successful and they have multi-million dollar deals to do their comedy shows and express their comedy. And once a month, I'm surprised by how good it is. And who is this? I don't know. So I think it's a good thing for the culture. I think it's a good thing for show business. I don't think all of the streaming platforms will survive, but yeah, more opportunity in almost any walk of life is a good thing.
I had Judd Apatow on the podcast, and Judd's been a good friend of mine for years. Judd's a person that was a part of my start, right? As are you. And I just want to make sure that I take the time. We're nowhere near done, but I got to take the time to just give you what I like to call your flowers. I want to make sure that you know this. People are now stars because of the association with you. I'm going to say that again, and I want to make sure lands, okay? I want to make sure that this lands. People are now stars because of the association with you. Going through the David Letterman pipeline was significant enough in several careers that it gave them value to basically become who they now are. At some point in time, although you're on the journey of new and you know, erasing a lot of this old, I want to make sure, David, that you sit down at some point in time or stand up when you're fishing next and just laugh. Just take a second to laugh at the amount of stars that are now able to live the life that they live, to do the things that they're doing, because in the beginning of their career, the stamp of approval came from you. Well, and I know it's a crazy thing to think about.
Yes.
Right?
You're kind to say these things, and you're very kind to say this. And thank you, and it's something to think about, and I will think about it. And let's just say it's true. I wish now, hearing this from you, that I had been aware of it in the process. I would have been far more generous to people coming through our pipeline than maybe I was, because you have to manifest a large degree of ego and selfishness to be in show business. But hearing this now, Kevin, makes me think, holy crap, if this was going on, I should have paid closer attention to it. I should have nurtured this more. And maybe I did. I don't even know how you nurture something like this. I mean, maybe just by virtue of being there, people benefit from it. I don't know. But now I wish I had actually tended this crop, as we say in the Bible. Do they say that in the Bible?
I don't want to say that they don't, but I'm willing to bet that they probably do. Yeah, I don't want to say they don't, because I'm like, if I was a strong reader,
I'll check it when I get back to the house.
I would have to know it inside and out to say that they do. So that's a way to back up your partner. I don't want to say that they don't. You can say that.
Right? Just, yeah, that's right.
I'm here for you, right? I'm on your side.
You show me where they don't say that.
Yeah, that's it. That's all I'm saying. No, I just thought it was good to say that to you, man. I told Judd, you know, the same way I told Judd, I said, you know, there's so many careers in comedy that have popped because of your blessing to put them on screen. And, you know, I said the same thing to Ice Cube. There's certain people that just have a talent with just an attachment to other talent. And that attachment is acted as a slingshot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether you see it or not, I'm a student of it. I sit back and I watch it and I rewatch it. And I clearly understand. Clearly understand.
I saw what you're talking about in Johnny Carson. I saw it in Steve Allen. And I saw it at the Comedy Store when Richard would come in. I saw it happen there. So I've recognized what you're saying in others, because, you know, those, well, especially Richard and Johnny and anybody else at that level in those days, that was powerful. And I understand the magnetic attraction there.
When you look back at it and you talk about just the stand-up time, you know, back then, and you talk about just the conglomerates, you know, that were around that you were a part of, you know, you're in that circle of comedy, of comedians. Who was the most mind-blowing to you back then?
When I first got there in 1975, I got to Los Angeles, and the person that just knocked the wind out of you was a guy named Tim Thomerson. And here was a guy who later had a very successful career as a film actor, but in those days, he would destroy the room. I mean, really beat up the room. And then I guess then Freddie Prinze would come in and same thing. And here was a kid, he was 19 or something, maybe 20. I don't know. The other person like that was Robin Williams.
Mm.
And then Richard, you know, these were, I mean, these guys were the Rocky Mountains, you know, mm. you're standing there looking up. And I'm sure I'm leaving other names out of there.
It's a great list.
Well,
it's a great list.
You know, Joan Rivers had the same effect. She didn't, I don't think she worked the Comedy Store, but she worked in the neighborhood, certainly, and was a great influence for people. Yeah, that's, I'll start with that. You know, but the list is longer than what I can recall right now.
That's crazy. I could talk to you, dude, for hours and just really be engulfed into the world of story.
Did you go through the Comedy Store?
I didn't come up in it. I came up through New York. So getting into the Comedy Store wasn't a problem when I finally got out here. But I was never engulfed into the world of it. Like I would come and I would do a set here and there. But I was never like a part of a consistent rotation because at that point I was already on the road. I was doing comedy clubs and colleges at the time. So I didn't spend a high amount of time in the LA comedy circuit. The New York is where I fought tooth and nail and got into that circuit, you know, and didn't want to leave it. You know, I was doing six sets a day in the New York comedy circuit. And the LA one, I felt like it was different from coming from the New York one because I felt like the comedians in LA, I felt like didn't wanna, everybody always performed as if that's the night that they were going to get shows. Mm-hmm. And what I felt LA lacked was the world of workout, right? New York embraced the world of workout. During the week, we're working on material. I got my paper, my pad, and I'm doing my jokes. And on the weekend, here comes the bigger shows and everybody's doing their best to bring it. And, you know, in LA, every show, people are doing the best of the best that they got. And it's all about the kill because who's in the audience?
That's right. Well, this is exactly what I'm thinking as you're telling about this. It was there was no room in LA. When I was there, it was the Comedy Store. That was it. And then there was a place called The Horn, which was kind of like a showroom, and they would have music and maybe a comic. And then Bud Friedman came out with the Improv. So then you had two places, the Comedy Store and the Improv. And it was L.A. And one night, William Morris would buy out the house. One night, ICM would buy out the house. And so you just didn't have the opportunity, or in my case, too afraid to actually mature. Because you had your 5-10 minutes and that you knew that was all you were required to do. And you knew that that would get you on television. So you didn't really grow. You grew to the level of what will get me on the Merv Griffin show. And then you stopped producing.
Mm.
But what you're describing is a community of growth where, by God, I know I got to keep working. I know I got to keep working. But in Los Angeles, you didn't want to have a bad night. Because even if there wasn't somebody in the audience, I can remember one time I was, there was a comedian named Pete Barbeauty who was very funny and a club act and avant-garde and interesting and peculiar, but very funny. And he had to cancel a couple of gigs. So he recommended me and a buddy of mine, George Miller. And one of these things was a banquet in Idaho for a real estate company, Salesman of the Year Awards. And of course, you know, you're going to have comedy at Salesman of the Year Awards in real estate in Idaho. So I get up there and it's a podium and a gooseneck microphone. And I do my 20 minutes, dead silence, get on the plane and go home. And later I find out that the Pete Barbeauty's manager called up Freddie DeCordova at the Tonight Show and said, listen, I keep hearing that you're having thoughts about bringing Letterman on the Tonight Show. Let me tell you, I just saw the kid bomb in Idaho. So it was, you just didn't know, you know, this was the world we were living in. I mean, he was right. I bombed in Idaho. I got no problem with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. That's a fact. Idaho, yeah. It didn't go good for me. I bombed there. It's all right. It's not a big deal, guys. That was a bad one for me. Idaho is not going to be a strong market for me. Write it down. Yeah. Write it down.
Look, it's their problems, not mine.
I see, this is what I love the most about your show now. I love you being loose in the front. I love you doing crowd work. And not because, you know, it's the comedian. It's just you just look comfortable. You just look so comfortable and at ease. And it shows. It shows from your body posture. It shows from your wardrobe. And it shows just from your conversation with guests.
You know what it's like. It got to be fun for me on the old show, just talking to the audience before we rolled the video. And I loved it. And it's good. It relaxes you. It maybe gets them on your side, but it's fun. And the pressure is off a little because it's not the official show. So it's fun. Yeah, I enjoy that.
Last question. Most intriguing guest that you feel that you've had the opportunity to talk to.
Most intriguing.
Intriguing, right?
Yeah, elaborate on the word.
When I say intriguing, and I'm going to say the guest that you found yourself most shocked and amazed at their mindset, right? Like I sometimes can meet a person and the conversation grows into such a crazy space of not big words, but mind fuck, right? Where you find a person's approach to life, understanding to life, where they are, what they're doing, and it's wrapped up into a small conversation, but it really makes you go, wow, that person, hey man, that was a dope conversation. The energy that person just put out, I received. That person's got some good energy that gets put out. Who hit you with the ball of refreshing energy that you can remember to date?
This is a pretty good question, and I wish I had a pretty good answer, but I'm going to do my best.
Okay.
And based on your elaboration of intrigue, it was a young woman who lives in Los Angeles, who's in the music world, very successful, by the name of Lizzo. Mm. My prior expectation of this experience was at its best neutral. Mm-hmm. Because if you're in show business, typically, and we talked about this a little earlier, typically you're expected to meet a certain level. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people in show business don't meet that level. So my expectation, and I studied her life, and I studied her for about 6 weeks, and I knew of her, knew what she did. She had been on the old show. But almost everything you said about my reaction to her after the fact happened. Mm. Delighted, comfortable, didn't want to leave, wanted to stay in her house, wanted to help her. I wanted to go around and find out who was handling her. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to screen them. I wanted to make sure she was being taken care of because I found her spirit, Kevin, to be, and maybe I'm hyperbolic here on this, but I found her spirit to be huge. Mm. Not like anything I had experienced. I know there are people like that. And I know there are people like that in show business, but this particular episode I was delighted by, for still am.
Wow.
So while that doesn't answer your question,
that does.
Well, not the nightly show. I would have to go back and think about that.
But that's, I said in general, it didn't have to be night. Just yeah, in general. Well, like
recently, I think that she had the greatest impact on me. Now, you know, I don't mean to be selling others short, but it's just when you elaborated, I thought it's still her.
I totally get it.
Yeah,
I totally get it. She's a vibrant personality, a good person too. I've met Lizzo a couple of times, really good person. And speaking of good person, man, I got to just talk about you and just say what a good person you are. And this conversation, man, it was dope. It was educating. It was refreshing. And it's an honor to be on the opposite side, right? Like, you know, this is what you do. And for me to be able to sit on this side and talk to you and ask you questions, dude, it's an honor. This is a humbling experience and a notch I'm going to put on my goddamn professional belt. And it's one that I'm putting a gold star next to because I don't take it for granted.
Let me say one thing here. My expectation for this experience, I wasn't sure what to expect. You're really good at this.
Thank you, man.
And I've enjoyed this immensely. And I have this feeling. I know it's not accurate, but I always, like when other people are on this Netflix show, if it goes really well, I have this emotional feeling that I always express by saying to the person, I love you. And I think later, no, wait a minute, really? Is that accurate? I don't know, but that's the way I feel about you. So God bless you, my friend.
Thank you, man. Guys, this is Comedy Gold Mines. And what is this about? Well, it's about getting into the amazing minds of comedians. And oh my God, what amazing minds they are. And today was no different. God, how privileged are we? We got inside the mind of David Letterman. It doesn't get any better. David, man, I appreciate you. I am forever a fan. I am forever a supporter. And dude, forever a friend. If you ever need me, I'm here. And I mean that. And hey, look, I don't fish, but if you want me to grab the net one time and come out there with you, you got yourself a date, buddy. All right.
Well, that's great, because who needs the kid?
I will join you any day. David Letterman, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, man.